Good evening.
Good evening.
It's good to see people again. I've been gone for a few weeks, and good to see old friends and see new faces also. Welcome tonight. I've been gone in this 21-day ceremony that, you know, it had an impact on me because it was so long and so deep. So, of course, I can't help talking about it tonight. So, I'll try to tell you a little bit about this ceremony called Dharma Transmission or Dharma Inheritance. Two different names for the same ceremony. Denpo is transmission of Dharma. That's maybe from the point of view of the teacher, transmission of Dharma. And from the point of view of the disciple, it's inheriting Dharma, Shiho. Transmission and inheritance. And, you know, what can be said about it? Many things could be said, but none of them quite reach what it is. And it's basically enacted through a ceremony. That's what we can, you know, talk about in a kind of tangible way. And at its heart, it's really about the relationship between teacher and student. It seems to me that's what is being revealed through this ceremony. And in my case, I'll tell a little bit about this, and excuse me, Rob, who was with me last night in Monterey, where I maybe told many of these things will be repeated tonight. So my teacher, Tenshin Reb Anderson Roshi, I first met 20 years ago this summer. It could have been right around now, sometime in the summer at Tassajara. And my relationship with him was quite different that year compared to what it is now, as all relationships evolve over years. I remember the first Dokusan I had with him, the first, you know, individual meeting. I really didn't want to sign up, but I also did. You know, I was there at Tassajara. I was 23 years old, and I heard that the abbot was coming. And people said, "Oh, this is a good opportunity. You should sign up to talk with the abbot." Oh, I don't know. Maybe too much to just sit in a room like so close, face to face like that. But so I went into the room with a lot of fear. And as soon as I got in the room, the fear was dispelled, almost completely dispelled. I don't remember what we talked about at all, but I remember that feeling very much, that this warm-hearted, gentle openness. And at the same time, very upright and present presence was there to meet me. And then just over time, I was drawn to spend more time with him. And I think we sometimes feel like, as we get more into practice, like people start saying, "Do you have a teacher?" Or we think, "I should have a teacher," or something like that. And in San Francisco, the Zen Center, where there's many teachers, it sometimes gets challenging because it's like, I feel some connection with this person, but this one too. So who's going to be my teacher? And I think for me, it wasn't so. It wasn't such a conscious thing. It was just a natural connection with this person. at some point, I suppose I started thinking of him as my teacher, but it was at first, I think it was more like, there's something really interesting about what this person's saying that I don't quite understand, but I want to hear more because I don't understand. And I think also at the beginning of that, of a teacher-student relationship like that, or at least in my case, and I think in many cases, there's a lot of projection onto the teacher of, and he's a good landing pad for projection himself. He's a very dynamic character. And projection raising the teacher to a elevated status of like a god or something. Sometimes I felt that way. And which is definitely still a connection. There's a strong connection there when we do that, but it's also a separation to do that. So I think over time the relationship becomes more intimate as the projection drops away more and more, which is a little bit sad also, I think, because our idealized version of a person changes, and then it's like they're just a regular person. And so there were times when I felt like I want to spend the rest of my life practicing with this person, and then maybe later over time I felt like maybe this isn't my teacher after all, and even this whole tradition. I was pretty hooked on Buddha Dharma, but I thought maybe not this Soto Zen way and this teacher, and he's not really where it's at. And then oftentimes when I'd be going down that path of like getting ready to go in my mind, something would happen between us that would like renew that relationship, that would be like, oh wow, I was getting into this whole kind of idea about him that different than my earlier ideas, and now it was just broken again, and like, there's no, I can't go, there's something here. And so over time it I think naturally it becomes an interesting relationship over a long time. And as thinking, except for my parents, there's no other close relationship I've had with anyone for 20 years, or even close to that, staying in touch with them almost maybe every month through that time, and how he changes over that time, and I change, and it becomes somewhat more like a friendship. And yet, it's not just an equal friendship either. There's always this teacher-student thing. So I think that's something that's really dynamic about this kind of relationship, is it's unequal and it's equal also. And the ceremony at this, I'm coming back from, enacts some of those qualities of equality and inequality, and honors them both. I think they're both important and ritually honored in terms of how certain kinds of bowing are done and things like that. So in the ceremony itself, at some point the teacher feels it's time to ritually enact this this intimacy through this ceremony that's very, and I think it's probably done in all different ways, and particularly throughout American Zen. But my teacher is very traditional, and so we did this 21-day ceremony that was completely like by the book. We have a translation of the Japanese manual for this ceremony and just completely thorough, very formal, very ritualized, very like involved. The last week in particular is like kind of all day. There was barely time to eat in between events. And the events are mostly like things that we do all the time in Zen, of like bowing, lots of bowing. At one point, I just for fun, I calculated in the 21 days how many full prostrations there were, and over 3,000 in 21 days. Partly it's like you're bowing, there's 100 bows at a time each day to each of the ancestors in the lineage. So a lot of it is it's about the teacher and student is the main emphasis, I would say, but then maybe it's kind of secondary, or the same even, I would say, but in a different form, is that the ancestral lineage, because you're basically connecting with that lineage. The ceremony is like fusing you into the lineage. So there's all these names, and a lot of them we have these beautiful stories and we know about them. And a lot of them we have no idea who they were, particularly the ancestors after Dogen, a few generations after Dogen, up to a few generations before Suzuki Roshi, who brought our tradition to America. All those kind of later Japanese ancestors, we don't know anything. We just have their names, often beautiful names, but we don't know about them. And still, I felt this strong connection day after day, like doing a bow to each of their names, because they're all links. They're all like indispensable links in this stream of transmission of Dharma. Even if they were like really lousy practitioners, still they did something, and probably what they did, if nothing else, was this ceremony. It looks like this ceremony has its roots in Dogen. A lot of it comes from Dogen, and probably because Dogen was really into what was happening in China, probably goes quite far back before him. But a lot of it is ritually enacting Dogen Zenji's transmission ceremony, and partially like the transmission of the sixth ancestor, because we know have some stories about that. For example, in the Platform Sutra of the sixth ancestor, there's a midnight passing on of the robe and bowl. So we do the ceremony at midnight, and it's this very private, intimate ceremony. And unlike, you know, like a priest ordination or a lay ordination is a very public event, this is unusual. It's the only ceremony I think there is in Zen where it's very just private, personal thing. It's completely involved for all these days, but it's just teacher and student, and maybe some other, you know, instructors helping out and attendants and so on. But, you know, like I felt like I was on some kind of like personal retreat at Green Gulch where I was doing this. I had no idea what was going on in the community. And it partly involves creating these documents. It's actually a huge part of the last week, taking maybe almost 2 full days to make each of 3 documents with ink on silk, mostly with names of the ancestors in various formats and other symbolic representations of Dharma. And the teacher and disciple are kind of making the documents together. The student does most of it, but the teacher adds in parts too, and they seal them together, and then the documents are actually used in the final ceremony too, used and given. So it's sort of like a legal documentation, but it's also like art. And the final two nights are the transmission of precepts, and then the transmission of Dharma. There's two different ceremonies at night, and transmission of precepts is almost the same as our precept ceremonies that many of you have seen and been through. Same precepts, and it's a little bit more formal and elaborate ceremony, and some extra parts added in. But it's basically, in this one, it's like you're receiving the precepts again, maybe for the second or third time or more. But you're this is when you're fully imbibing them. You're fully taking them in order to be able to transmit them outward. So they're like, the precepts are like injected into you. And so that you can then give them, you can ordain lay people and priests and so on. And then the transmission of Dharma is the kind of final, you know, what is Dharma in the end? You might wonder, well, what's this Dharma that's being transmitted? And it's no specific thing. I mean, it's in the most tangible way we could talk about it, it's this ceremony is the transmission, is what's being transmitted. The Dharma of this particular ceremony. And the ceremony is enacting this intimacy between the teacher and student. Most of what is happening in it is actually a ritualized connection that's already formed between the teacher and student, but you're over and over again in more and more intimate ways, you're expressing that connection in a very formal kind of way. And sometimes we think that the deepest intimacy would be formless, would have no form. And I think in Zen we can see that. I think our forms of practice, like how we do things or how we bow and make offerings and chant and sit zazen, of course, our posture and all of that, all these forms are our expression of intimacy. I think that's what they're for, actually. And we can see them on many levels and they have many functions, but I think this is one of the big ones. And it maybe takes some time of doing them to feel that function. Of course, for all of us, at first, learning a new form feels awkward and doesn't feel at all intimate. It just feels confusing and makes no sense, and it feels awkward and doesn't feel like being ourselves. But anything we do over time does feel more natural, and like then we're really expressing ourselves through a form. And like, for example, a musical instrument, you know, like you learn scales when you're learning chords and stuff. You're just practicing scales, and it doesn't feel very creative or natural or intimate. It's just mechanical, but you're learning that. And then once you learn it, then you can play music. And then other people have been learning maybe the same instrument over here, then you can play together, and then you can start improvising through the form, and you know, based on the form, it can be very creative and spontaneous. And but to just improvise music without having learned the instrument first, it's not very fun. I mean, you can do it, but it's not as, I would say, it's not as fun or as intimate or beautiful as if you've learned it first and then you kind of go beyond it in a way, but you're still not really beyond it. You're still in the form, too. And to carry the musical instrument metaphor a little further, too, it's like, we could say Soto Zen. This tradition is like, it's just like a specific, you know, it's like a mandolin. So, and then we have like maybe Rinzai Zen is like a guitar, and Vipassana is like a flute or something, you know. And all these instruments you can learn, and they're all related. They're all playing music, and we don't say any are better than any others. They're all beautifully expressed music, and yet they're these specific instruments that are learned. And I had that feeling during the ceremony that that there's a specific, very beautiful instrument that's being like played like really wholeheartedly during this time. I had a new feeling about our tradition through after practicing a long time in this tradition, in this ceremony, a little bit different take on it. Not so different, but. And hard to say what it is. If I had to put my finger on it, I don't know if I could say, but I think it's something, though, about intimacy. It was just, that point was just driven home. And I think they have similar ceremonies like this in maybe Rinzai Zen. But I think they might, I would guess that some of the flavor would be a little bit different. So there's something about the style, and what's being transmitted is different than maybe Rinzai Zen and surely Vipassana and Tibetan transmissions, which there are also, you know, they're all very similar and all totally related and inform each other, but I think it's nice if we don't mix them all together, right? If we can practice even within different traditions, but really honor each one completely as its own art form, as its own instrument. So an example I thought of is like about, well, you know, what is this that's being passed along here? There's this intimacy, and another name for the ceremony actually is face-to-face transmission. Or menju, which literally means face conferring or face giving. We kind of expand that, you know, in English to say face-to-face transmission. But literally, it's just these two characters. Face, like the face. Face giving. Face conferring. And it's a really important point in Soto Zen in particular that Dogen Zenji, the founder, really was emphasizing is that this transmission must be face-to-face. It has to be like a human-to-human intimate connection. So for example, Dogen in his fascicle and his Shobogenzo masterpiece, he writes about face-to-face transmission, and he says, for example, there was this Chinese teacher who heard these teachings of Master Yunmen in China, and he had some insight when he heard those teachings, and said, because I awoke through Yunmen's teaching, I am now his heir. I inherited Yunmen's Dharma, even though he lived hundreds of years before me. And then he started a new kind of Yunmen lineage. And there's other examples of this too in old China. And Dogen's very critical of this. He says, no, even if you had some insight hearing that, you know, we're not going to discredit that. But it's not a actual body-to-body, face-to-face connection. It doesn't, it's not alive. The bloodstream is not flowing between living beings in the same way. The word, actually, the image of blood and words like blood vein and blood lineage, and the documents have, you know, red blood lines going through names. It's living, pulsing life, blood, life vein. So how could that be, you know, leapt across hundreds of years with no face-to-face connection? So before I bring up this example that I was thinking about, just a little bit from Dogen to get his sense of this face-to-face transmission. He says, Shakyamuni Buddha saw Venerable Mahakashyapa in person. That's in the Zen story, Shakyamuni Buddha, our Indian founder, transmitted Dharma, according to Zen, to Mahakashyapa, the first Zen ancestor. When Mahakashyapa smiled when the Buddha picked up a flower, it's one of these classic Zen stories. It may or may not have happened, but that was the first connection. So Dogen's writing about, and Venerable Mahakashyapa saw Venerable Ananda in person, and Venerable Ananda bowed formally to Venerable Mahakashyapa's Buddha face. This is face-to-face transmission. Thus, the authentic ancestors of all generations have continued face-to-face transmission, disciple seeing teacher and teacher seeing disciple. There must be this face-to-face transmission. It's like pouring water into the ocean and spreading it endlessly, or like transmitting the lamp and allowing it to shine forever. In thousands and millions of transmissions, the trunk and branches are one, breaking an eggshell by pecking from the inside and outside at once. And the image here is that the teacher is like the mother hen pecking on the egg on the outside, and the disciple's like the chick inside the egg pecking from the inside, and together they break the egg that traps us in our limited container, the egg of barriers, and the egg between the mother and the chick, so they can meet face to face. And the trunk and branches are one. There's often these kind of images of, we could say like the trunk is like this bloodline streaming through all the ancestors. There's just one bloodline, and then the branches are like all these different ancestors, different people, and unique individual people. But there's something that's that connects them. Mahakashyapa respectfully regarded Shakyamuni Buddha while making offerings and bowing formally. Thousands of times Mahakashyapa had pounded his bones and crushed his body. His face was no longer his own. Pounded his bones and crushed his body. Maybe like like dissolved himself, like in a mortar, ground himself up until he was dissolved into indistinguishable, letting go of himself. Strange image, maybe a little strong image, but if we could see it as a, like food processing, till his face was no longer his own. Thus, he received the Tathagata's face by means of face-to-face transmission. So, he still had a unique personality, Mahakashyapa. He wasn't the same personality as the Buddha. That's not what it's about. But more like, he wasn't holding his own identity. And just open, an open face, ready to receive the next face that comes, which is the Buddha's face. And then the Buddha's face was in this image. It's almost like it's literally given. He receives the Buddha's face. I just thought of this image of one of the arhats in China. They depict these 16 or 18 arhats, and they're like these kind of mythical Dharma protectors in China. And they're like very strange. They have like magical powers, I think is what they're emphasizing. So one of them's got this arm that's like, the statue's maybe this tall and the arm's like 20 feet tall, like reaching up to get something. Like that's, so the statues are very interesting. And one of them is an arhat, like he's like peeling back his face and like the Buddha's face is inside his own face. So that kind of image. But it's not like becoming the teacher, you know. That's the, I think, again, there's this, the teacher and student are like friends, close friends, and yet there's this difference also. There's hierarchy and there's non-hierarchy, and they're both totally honored in the same way that the Buddha's face is received, so it's the Buddha, but one's own face is still oneself, almost like becoming more oneself, becoming more completely who one is, not having to kind of copy the teacher, something like that. Becoming more authentically oneself, and yet it's like, it's different than if we had just like been authentically ourself on our own. It's like that authentic self is completely informed by the teacher's face. The authentic face of the disciple is made by the teacher's authentic face. So they could be completely different. They could have a big argument about how things should be and still be completely intimate. His Mahakashyapa's face was no longer his own. And at that moment that it was no longer his own, you could say he received the Tathagata's face, the Buddha's face. The face skin is the great round mirror of all Buddhas. Because they have the great round mirror as their face skin, they are unmarred inside and outside. A great round mirror transmits to a great round mirror. So, reflecting one another, which is, you know, all of this too can sound maybe kind of like mystical and this special event that happens, but all of it is also, you know, happening, I think, all the time between all of us. It's just, this is, you know, enacting it in this special kind of way, and yet the way that we meet each other and reflect each other all the time is the same thing, actually. It's just stopping and looking at it really carefully and presently in this ceremony. So thinking about, you know, these different types of instruments again, there's this link in our Soto Zen lineage that you may have heard about this, where in China, before it got to Dogen, where there was this one teacher in our chant, that in Japanese we say Taiyo Kyogen Daiyosho, and he was getting old and he didn't have a successor, and this was a problem for him. And which is, incidentally, this is a one of the main things about this ceremony that I just don't want to forget to mention. But and I don't, different people might see this differently, but talking with my teacher about this just recently before the ceremony, you know, what is this, what's really at the heart of this here, or the meaning? And his response is that it's all about passing it on. So the ceremony might feel like a great gift. For me, it did feel like maybe the greatest gift I've ever received, actually. A very, very heart-moving gift. And with this huge responsibility of that it must be passed on. In the ceremony, many times the words are actually said, do not let this be cut off in the future. Meaning that, at least the way he talks, my teacher is talking to me, is that your main job now is to actually find a successor and pass this on. Like, you know, don't wait too long. You know, like, come on, just give me a chance to just be here and receive this for a little bit. Like, no, he's, you know. And for me, this was a 20-year process, right? So so it's very intimidating. If it was going to be the same way, it's hard to imagine how that could go. And maybe it doesn't have to take that long. But it's a tall order to feel. I mean, the ceremony could be done right now. It's like I'm empowered to do the ceremony, but it wouldn't make any sense. You know, it wouldn't like how to get to the point. The how to build a relationship such that the ceremony would have the feeling that it did for me. I'm not sure if feeling is quite the right word, but something, the impact. So anyway, this, I think it looks like this Taiyo Kyogen felt like he didn't want to let this stream die, this particular instrument. There were all these other, I don't know about all these other, but there was, because it looks like this is the only, so, well, I guess there were other like Soto, Chinese Soto lineages probably in China, and probably still are, but the only one that came down to Dogen, right? There's only one line up to Dogen, and he was part of that, and he didn't want to let it die out, but he hadn't found a successor. And so he met this teacher, another practitioner, and they it says something like their minds were in accord, at this time, there was this teacher in the Linji line. Basically, yeah, let me just say what happened. They met Taiyo Kyogen and this other practitioner met, and they felt like they clicked. They had some accord with Dharma. And he said, I'd like to pass my Dharma to you, and pretty quickly, because I'm getting old. And this other teacher said, but I've already received Dharma in the Linji lineage. So another thing that Dogen talks about is that it's a one-time thing. You can't receive like multiple lineages. And you can have many teachers, but you only receive Dharma from one teacher. And once it's done, it's done. It's irrevocable, irreversible. It might not be your ordination teacher necessarily, but this is at this point, it's like no return. You might disagree with him later, but you can't avoid, this relationship is like sealed. It's like a marriage, but you can't get divorced. He said, I've already received this, but I actually honor your practice and your, and I feel your heartfelt wish to keep this Soto lineage alive, so I'll hold it for you and I'll pass it on to somebody for you, like a surrogate mother. And that's what happened. So Taiyo Kyogen died, and this other teacher, Rinzai teacher, practiced and maybe transmitted his Linji, Rinzai lineage, but he held this other one on the side, even though it wasn't his own style, and then he later passed that on to Tosu Gise. So in our lineage chant, we don't chant the name of this Rinzai ancestor. I feel like we kind of should, because that makes the face-to-face connection. But I think it's interesting that it's put in there, partly because it looks like the point being face-to-face so emphasized in the Soto tradition, but there was this link where it looks like it wasn't exactly that way, and yet there was a face-to-face transmission. It's just that ancestor doesn't get listed. And I bring it up partially because it's like, why didn't he just say, well, you know, just we're great friends, and here's some Soto Zen teachings, and like next time you pass on the Rinzai lineage, maybe you can include some of these too. It's like, no, there's these two distinct instruments with distinct sounds, and you know, what they are, what makes them distinct, is hard to say, actually. It's very subtle, I think, and very intimate. That heart of the style of this, of a school of practice. So, and in old China, it might have been very specific teachings or something like that. But I think now it's something like a style of practice, and it's a lot to do with intimacy. And so. One last little story here. This book is called The Record of Transmitting the Light, or Transmission of Light, which is the stories of the Dharma transmissions of the ancestors from the Buddha up to Dogen's disciple in Japan. So it's the stories of their connections. A beautiful book. And Liang Shan Yuan Quan Ryozan Enkan Daiyosho in China was studying with Doan Kanshi, and he was his attendant, and his teacher said, when he was, the attendant was passing him the robe, the Dharma robe, like this kind of robe, and which is made up of this patchwork pattern, right? It's sewn together with these patches. And Doan Kanchi said, "What's the business beneath the patch robe?" And the student couldn't answer. He had no answer. And so his teacher said, "Studying the Buddha way and still not reaching this realm is the most painful thing. Not being able to answer this. What is the matter, the business, the great matter beneath the patch robe? Now you ask me." So the student asked, "Well, what's the business beneath the patch robe?" And Doan said, "Intimacy." And the student was greatly awakened. I think that's something to do with the style of our school, that the business beneath the patch robe, beneath, which is a form, right? It's a specific form, and we have these sewing classes where we sew these robes in a very particular way, which many of you have done. It's a form, but so what's beneath that? What's beneath that form? Intimacy. And I think that's the beneath all our ceremonial forms, and beneath zazen, particularly the form of sitting upright silently together. We could say, well, it's about concentration, it's about letting go of self. But we could also say it's about intimacy. We're sitting together. We sit together in a room. So that's a little snippet of some of what's been happening for me the last few weeks. If you'd like, do you have any questions or comments?
Yes. I just want to say heartfelt congratulations, and the shade of the brown robe becomes you.
Thank you. Yes.
Is there any talking during this time on days?
Oh, yes. Okay. I mean, not really talking in the community. Like, all my meals pretty much were silent. But with this teacher, there was a lot of talking. In fact, there was Dokusan. The last 7 days, there was Dokusan every day, and like a formal tea with discussion every day. And before that, it was like every other day. So many, 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 you know, dokusans. Some of them are like ritual transmissions of certain teachings and things like that. And other people were involved too in helping out some. So it was pretty silent. It felt a lot like being in sesshin. The last week in particular, it felt like a very active sesshin, in the sense that it was like very concentrated and focused. There was no time to do anything else, but like you're not just sitting there, like you're creating these documents, and then like suddenly it's like time to go do the next ceremony. And very focused and very, I think, and not exactly like we just do the ritual and then this ritual. It's more like teacher comes over and checks out how things are going, and then trying to figure out how to fold these things together and things like that. And me coming with questions and like, what about this name? And
are these documents private, or is that something that you can show us?
Yeah, they're kind of like a private thing. It's called Sanmotsu, these three documents that are, I think they're basically brought out at the time when you pass it on for the student to copy. Because so for me, so we had his documents were up on the wall for me to copy. And with his teachers, you know, writing and so on. So it's, you feel this link. And one, Dogen has an essay. I mean, you can read about it some, because in the Shobo Genzo, Dogen has an essay on one of the documents called the Shisho, the document of heritage. And Dogen is like so, you know, devotional that he's like freaked out about this Shisho. When he sees them in China, he starts crying just to like see somebody else's, you know. And I think there was this feeling in old China, like it was, Dogen tells a story, like there's this librarian somewhere and he says, have you ever seen one of these documents of heritage? Dogen's like, no, I'll like, you know, I'll give my life to see one. But, you know, he talks about it, and there's pictures too. You can find pictures on the internet even. And one of them is that you've seen, I think, because of, you received actually the blood vein Kechi Myaku document at Jukai. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's one of the documents. And we just, but it's a handmade copy with it, and the teacher writes on it. And the other one, the third one, is kind of like the very secret, intimate, like symbolic, coded document. And various things are passed along. A lot of it's very symbolic kind of things, but you feel the meaning behind the symbolism. Yes.
Can you say something about the process of years of thinking, yes, this is my teacher, you know, maybe not, maybe not, maybe, okay, maybe yes.
Yeah, I see it's getting time to stop too. But what is that? How does that work? I think it's like, or what's that thread that in times of great doubt of almost leaving? Sometimes it could be like attachment too, you know, and how much of it is like personal. I mean, I love him, right? It's like there's this very human connection, but that's not what it's about, you know. And it can easily get mixed up with that too. And so to you know, not come at it from that point of view, but like, what's the dharma behind this? Like, it's not that person, you know, it's totally personal, and yet it's not that personal. Like, I've never just kind of like hung out with him. I've never gone out to dinner with him in 20 years, right? So something So there's this this kind of different kind of relationship, and yet it's very personal too. And I think the times that brought me back from thinking about changing. It's hard to know what they were, you know. It's hard to think of specific things that happened, but I think, you know, he would say something that would go right to my heart, maybe something like that. It would really strike me in the heart and be like, oh, you know, I was looking at this really superficially, and now I am, or our relationship superficially, or something like that. And, but yeah, there's something wonderful about just going through changes. I mean, 20 years ago, and now he's a grandfather, and he's got a grandfather energy, very, very gentle, very quiet, and I feel like more formal, less like joking around maybe, more, but very, very, very warm feeling. But when I met him 20 years ago, he was a little older than me maybe, and he was pretty rowdy and pretty fierce, and he disturbed a lot of people. his fiery energy was a lot stronger, I think. And he did, I think at that time, if he was like he is now, I might not have been so attracted to it. But as a 23-year-old, I thought, this guy's rad. So
that was before the word rad.
Yeah, I guess maybe so.
Yeah.
Like the very first time that I met him, the very first class before going to Tassajara, I was at City Center waiting to go to Tassajara the first time, and the abbot's giving a class, so I went, and I don't remember what it was about or anything, but I just remember him saying, as the abbot saying, somebody questioned him about something, he said, well, you know, maybe we should just like burn down the Zen Center and just go like walk out into the streets and just be free and just help people. I was like, wow, the abbot thinks we should burn down the Zen Center. Again, I thought, that's rad. And one time we, in maybe that first summer early on, it was a mountains and waters retreat at Tassajara, and he started talking about like baptism and, you know, being purified by water or something like this. And it was early in the spring, the water very cold. And he said, okay, let's go do it now. I'm like, what? Come on. And we just like, in this very mindful, charged kind of way, had such an impression on me at the time. We walked down into the creek with all our clothes on, just like right completely into the water, the whole group of like 20 people. Freezing water very slowly. I remember walking down the path, everybody just totally drenched, including him, you know. Just like, I can't believe we just did that. He had his nice robes on and everything, you know. So, thank you for being here and indulging me with these stories. It's, you know, there's nothing else I could talk about tonight. I dedicate any merit arising from this discussion to the Buddhas and ancestors who have transmitted the light of Dharma up to today. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.